Well, let's start with just a little bit of in-house business, I guess. Today, without a doubt, we're going to finish up numbers, and you'll see in the bulletin that we are going to start into Joshua next week. In reality, we may start into the introduction to Joshua this week. In preparation, I kept looking at what we needed to do a good job leading into Joshua. And I kept running into something that we'll talk about a little later, but we're going to lead into Joshua, start it, so to speak, with an introduction that will begin in the last number of chapters of Deuteronomy. So we'll have a diversion through Deuteronomy to make a good running start into Joshua. The business I want to talk about was there are going to be a couple of weeks that are different in November. I found out this morning that the 16th, there's going to be an all-church Sunday school. I didn't ask questions, so I don't know details, but apparently Joshua Smith's going to be back in the States for a bit, and they're going to have an all-church Sunday school on November 16th. On November 23rd, and those of you that were here when we went through some of this before, I think we'll see this as a treat, but I'm going to be gone the 23rd of November, but I'm bringing back in some of the patterns of evidence videos. Beings we're getting ready to start into the book of Joshua, I'm going to assemble together to the best of my ability some of those videos that surround the place, the situation, and how Jericho is a problem for some people, how it's really solved, and the firmness of the scriptures' alignment with the realities that we can see in archaeology and other kinds of things that go right along with the Bible being absolutely on track and on target, and information about Jericho. So that I think you will find to be a treat. So that'll be a couple of diversions in November. We're in the time of the year for diversions almost. Once we hit the 1st of November, nothing seems to follow the pattern that lets me feel like we're in a regimen that's predictable. So we'll see how the rest of this year goes. If you haven't done your Christmas shopping yet, I guess you might as well get started, because here it is, whether we were looking for it yet or not, we're in that season where there are twists and turns in the schedule, and here comes Christmas, and it'll always be here 3 weeks before it should be. All right. So let's talk about where we've been. Last week we were in Numbers chapters 34. We started with the 13th verse. And some of this we went through pretty quickly. It was a little bit repetitive in cases, but it was reaffirmed to the tribes by Moses that east of the Jordan there would be 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, a half of Manasseh, and west of the Jordan there would be the other 9.5 tribes, and that would be they would be participating in allotting the land to the tribes and to the individual families. And God selected a leader for each tribe to participate in that land assignment. It was to be done by lots. The bigger the tribe, the more land. Or the bigger the family, the more land. And we looked, there was a whole list of leaders that God selected. Only one was readily recognizable or even had many other mentions in the scriptures, and that was Caleb for the tribe of Judah. And certainly he deserved that role, deserved to be that leader based on his attempt to sway the people to still take the promised land when they lacked the faith to do so. In chapter 35, we looked at cities for the Levites. They were to be given cities. They were to include a grazing area for the flocks, their flocks, as well as some grazing area for the city at large. There were going to be 48 cities total allotted to the Levites, and 6 of these were to be cities of refuge. 3 to the east of the Jordan and 3 to the west of the Jordan. There was a lot of expenditure of instruction words given regarding the cities of refuge. It was a place to flee to if a manslayer had killed somebody but didn't do so intentionally. And it was to apply to everyone in the land, not just Israelites, but anybody that happened to be within the borders and found themselves in that situation. They would flee to the city, and that would then, they would get a trial that would be done by the congregation. The congregation had to determine if they were, quote, murderers, or if it was another kind of man-slaying death. And so they were fleeing from the blood avenger, a representative of the family of the person killed, that whose job was to carry out the command first given to Noah, that if a man should have his blood shed, then mankind should shed the blood of the one that killed him. And so God is setting up this trial situation. That's what we would call it. And he gives guidance on what to look for a guilty verdict. That if he was struck down, these are examples, it's not the whole thing, but struck down by an iron object or a stone, or while lying in wait with hatred, intending to do harm, then it is murder, and the murderer shall surely be put to death. And that was to be done by handing the manslayer over to the blood avenger. If he was not guilty, that he would stay in the city until the current high priest died. And then he was free to go back to his own home. But not until then. If he happened to wander out, then the blood avenger was free to take his life without guilt on the blood avenger. And in the trial, God said, you can't rely on the testimony of one person. You've got to have more than one person give testimony before that would be considered valid, factual information to base their decision upon. And there also were to be no exceptions. You couldn't make ransom payments to get somebody freed or get them out of their death if they were found guilty. And God also talked about if blood was shed on the land, then that was defiles the land, and the only way to get the land back where out of defilement was if a murderer's blood dead was shed in as a result, and then the defilement was set aside. Questions, comments about it, about any of the what we did last week? Well, then let's move on to Numbers chapter 36. And we move back into an area that's been talked about before, but a problem is brought up. And so let me read the first 13 verses, and we'll see how this problem gets addressed. It's Numbers 36, 1 through 13. And the heads of the fathers' households of the family of the sons of Gilead, the son of Michar, the son of Manasseh, of the families of the sons of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the leaders, the heads of the fathers' households of the sons of Israel. And they said, the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land by lot to the sons of Israel as an inheritance. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. But if they marry one of the sons of the other tribes of the sons of Israel, their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of our fathers and will be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. Thus it will be withdrawn from our allotted inheritance. When the jubilee of the sons of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong, so their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. Then Moses commanded the sons of Israel, according to the word of the Lord, saying, the tribe of the sons of Joseph are right in their statements. This is what the Lord has commanded concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them marry whom they wish, only they must marry within the family of the tribe of their father. Thus no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from tribe to tribe, for the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. Every daughter who comes into possession of an inheritance of any tribe of the sons of Israel shall be wife to one of the family of the tribes of her father, so that the sons of Israel may possess the inheritance of the fathers, of his fathers. Thus, no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another tribe, For the tribes of the sons of Israel shall each hold to his own inheritance. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so the daughters of Zelophehad did. Mahla, Tirzah, Hogla, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, married their uncle's sons. They married those from the families of the sons of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained with the tribe of the family of their father. These are the commandments and the ordinances which the Lord commanded to the sons of Israel through Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho. Now, when I read through that myself the first time, I'm like, what did I just read? And I knew the initial issue was based on an answer that we had received and we chose when we looked at a problem that was brought up by these same daughters of Zelophehad, whatever, in chapter 27. Do you remember what the problem was?
They were the only remaining heirs.
They were the remaining heirs of Zelophehad, and they were all daughters. So they were not yet married. So when the land was allotted, what were they going to get if there wasn't a solution given?
Nothing.
They're going, hey, our father had a right to a portion of this land. They were from the tribe of Manasseh. And we think we ought to get what he would have received for us. And Moses took that to the Lord. And what did the Lord say?
Yes.
Yeah, good plan. Let's do that. And so this was communicated back to the tribes. But apparently some time has gone by, and so here we have some of the other men who had families in the tribe of Manasseh, and they say this creates a problem. And the problem goes like this. How did women, in their role in society, how did they wind up being a part of these inherited lands? In a normal situation,
marriage.
They would marry someone in the descendants of Jacob, and then they would go be attached to that person. And if they were in a different tribe, then when lands were allotted or inheritances happened, then they inherited with their husband and his family. Okay, that was great. But these guys say, wait a minute, we're getting a problem here. And so they're bringing it up. If it's a problem, if they marry outside their tribe, then if they go marry, then in that case, in the year of Jubilee, they will be taking some of our land and it will be transferred to another tribe. And so that brings us into this whole deal about what is Jubilee. And why is that a problem? Well, why that's a problem, I'll get into Jubilee in a minute, but these tribal areas expected that when they and their tribe received this land, as a tribe, they would keep that land in perpetuity. As the inheritances happened, it would still always be someone in that tribe that was going to own that land. And when we talk about Jubilee, you're going to see how that could get complicated. But they say, hey, when Jubilee comes, they would then get to take this land, but they're going to be connected with a different tribe if they marry outside the tribe. So Jubilee is a bit of the issue. Let's go over to Leviticus chapter 25, and we're going to look at verses 1 through 17. Leviticus 25. 1 through 17. This issue of families having a perpetual inheritance within their family as well as within the whole tribe had already come up. God had made it clear back in the words given to Moses, the laws on Mount Sinai, that this was going to be the case. And but in the law giving of Leviticus, we also have it under the name of Jubilee. And here is what goes on with the within the process of managing the land and managing the inheritances in Israel going forward after they entered the promised land. The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune to your vineyard and gather in its crop. But during the seventh year, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest aftergrowth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. All of you shall have a Sabbath, shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves, and your hired man and your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you. Even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat. You are also to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, so that you have time of the 7 Sabbaths of years, namely 49 years. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound the horn through all your land. You shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his family. You shall have the 50th year as a jubilee. You shall not sow nor reap its aftergrowth, nor gather in from its untrimmed vines. For it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its crops out of the field. On this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. If you make a sale, moreover, to your friend or buy from your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Corresponding to the number of years after the jubilee, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell to you according to the number of years of crops. In proportion to the extent of the years, you shall increase its price, and in proportion to the fewness of years, you shall diminish its price, for it is a number of crops he is selling to you. So you shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God." So these are years that relate to a number of things. One of them is how they're going to manage their land. Every seventh year, they will have a Sabbath year. The land gets a rest. There is no sowing, no pruning, and no reaping of the pruned crops from previous years. And all, including the animals, get to eat all of the crops. Now, that sounds a little confusing, doesn't it? I had to work a little bit to figure out how this language was being put together. But what happens is the crops that you planted and grew, you're not going to plant the next year, right? And you're not going to prune your grapes. And so there's a normal farming technique. But what you do get to consume is whatever comes up in a volunteer way. So they can consume out of those crops in the seventh year that comes up volunteer. I remember when we were switching crops around on my mother's dad's place, one of the things that we did was cut a lot of cane out of the milo fields and maybe out of the corn fields. And why was the cane there? Well, it was volunteer. And my grandfather said, yeah, a lot of years ago, a lot of us planted Johnson grass, and we might put it in the silage or whatever, but he said, that Johnson grass, it keeps coming up. So a lot of times what you might call volunteer in the modern world of rotating crops, we'd call weeds once they start volunteering. But these folks are going to eat out of what comes up volunteer. And before we're done, We'll also see that God offered them provision in another way. So you're going to have these 7 years of Jubilee, and beings you can't plant and you can't sow and reap in the normal way, it also turns out to be a time of rest every seventh year for the people. They get a chance to, you know, shouldn't we be planting the North 40? No, not this year. It's a Sabbath year. We'll just eat what grows on its own. And so that's how it worked. And they fed the animals, and the people that happened to be in their area that weren't Israelites. And they would do this seven times, which, of course, is going to add up to 49 years. On the 50th year, on the Day of Atonement, they're going to blow a horn. And now we have the year of Jubilee. And it's very similar in terms of how the land is managed. We don't sow. We don't prune. We're not going to live off of the things that a farmer would do. We're going to live off of the volunteer crops that come up. And like I say, later on, we're going to get to where they have some other provisions as well. But it's more than that in the year of Jubilee. In the year of Jubilee, it says each one goes back to his own property. There's more in those words than we would think of today. Because what that means is you're going to go back to your inherited land. So you're going to rejoin your family and your tribe on the land that was originally apportioned when they entered the promised land. And all sales of property are undone. If you bought that property, you don't own it anymore. It goes back to the family that had it. And so God even gives instructions. So if you're selling your land, or if you're the purchaser, how do you determine the value of the land? Well, you look at how long it was since the last Jubilee. And if this is year one, you can pay a lot more for it because you're going to get to use this land for 49 years or 48 or whatever, however you want to calculate that out. But if this is, we've already done the sixth Sabbath of the land, you only got just a few years. You're not going to be able to pay much for that property. God himself even says you're really not buying the land, you're buying the crops you can grow on the land. And so that's all you're getting because it's going to revert back. And so God gives instruction a couple times. Don't wrong one another. Be fair in this. And make this a part of your calculations for the sale. And that's why this issue with the ownership of the land of these women who would inherit it based on their father's allotment is a problem. Because when you hear it the year of Jubilee, if they have married into another tribe, well, now they're over in that tribe and they're going to be participating in the inheritance there, but they also own this land over here, and beings they fall under the man in another tribe, now the real control of this land within our tribe, they say, portions of it, as these women find husbands, and portions of it are going to belong to families in other tribes, and it's going to get all mixed up. And so there's an easy solution that God brings to the table and lays in place. They can marry whoever they want, provided they're in the same tribe they are. Now they're not marrying out of the tribe. Now you're not going to have the tribe of Judah inheriting land through this year of Jubilee or getting land back for daughters in the land that's with some other tribe. So now everything gets to stay the same. So these men of Manasseh that had come forward get a solution to the problem. There's some other things, though, that I think we ought to talk about. And so I've got a few of them. I'm going to read the verses, a few of them I'm going to tell you about that happened with regard to this year of Jubilee, because it sounds like these might be pretty skinny years for your consumption if you don't know some of these other verses. So I'm going to go down. I want to read to you verses 19 through 22. In Leviticus 25, 19 through 22. Then the land will yield its produce so you can eat your fill and live securely in it. But if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we don't sow and gather in crops? Then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when the crop comes in. In other words, God says, you're living under my direction. You're living in obedience to me. I'm going to bless you that on the years preceding, for the Sabbath year, I'm going to send to you a double crop on the sixth year. That way you can receive that. And if we looked at all of this, we would see that on the seventh Sabbath, that he's going to give them 3 years of crops, because you're going to have on the sixth year, right before the seventh Sabbath, you're going to get 3 years of crops, because we're going to provide enough for the Sabbath, but we also are going to provide for the Jubilee. So the people will have to use some self-control about saving portions of that crop going forward. But God said, I'm going to take care of you. Don't fear these Sabbaths. These are a time that are be holy, to be worshipful, to be dependent upon God. And you can use what comes up as volunteer, but otherwise you can live off of what I provided you in the previous year's harvest. Questions or comments so far? Well, and as a matter of fact, I didn't prepare for this, so I'm going to say some things off the top of my head that are going to be close, but maybe not 100% accurate, okay? Part of what determined the length of their exile was they weren't keeping the Sabbath years. And God said, fine, you're going to be in exile equivalent to the number of those Sabbath years. And so they paid a big price for not doing what was done here. In what preparation I did for today, some of the commentators think that they may have never really truly implemented this Sabbath year or this Jubilee as intended, because of the length of time it took them actually even to take all of the promised land. They drug their feet. We're going to see some of that in Joshua. They didn't get things done like God told them to. They didn't do things exactly as God told them to, not just in regard to timing, but some other things. So we're not sure how many times they might have celebrated the Sabbath year, but they neglected this badly. And that determined part of their exile time, at least in the case of Judah, I believe. You can go read that and you can find all my errors and come back and tell me next time. I'm fine with that. Because I don't have all that down firmly where I can be absolutely certain I got all of that just perfectly right. Good question. Other questions? Okay. Which, by the way, you bring up the exile. Part of what we're going to look at the end of the book of Deuteronomy is the closeout of Moses and his death. And that issue of the potential for an exile comes up there. Not potential. It comes up there. In verse 23, this business about selling the land, God makes an outstanding statement here that I don't think the Israelites, to a large extent, incorporated into their understanding of who they were in relationship to God and what it meant to get the, quote, promised land. Verse 23. The land, moreover, I'm still in Leviticus 25. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. So who owned the land? Even they themselves as Israelites didn't own the land like we think we own our land. Might be a lesson in there for us. No, 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 let me take the might out. There's a lesson in there for us. God grants us the privilege of using his creation, even having some dominion over it. He even told Adam to exercise dominion over the garden. But he didn't say exercise dominion over your garden, Adam. Exercise your dominion over my garden. It was God's garden all the way through, but Adam was to go in and to take control of things, to tend to the garden, to tend to the animals, to make it what the best it could be under his areas of responsibility. But here is God saying, it's mine. So don't be upset about my rules on what you can do with it as far as ownership is concerned. And my rules about what happens on a Jubilee year wasn't yours to begin with. It'll never truly be yours, Israel. It's mine, but I'm putting it under your control as a promised land. I think that has some very interesting points for us to think about when we think about today's world and all the tensions that are in it. Whose land is it? Does it belong to Israel? Does it belong to the Palestinians or somebody else? When you get right down to it, none of the people whose name comes up in the popular conversations today does it truly belong to. This is God's land, and if he is determined now to gather the Israelites back on that land in that area and go back to the promise of where the borders were, there isn't a nation on earth that's going to keep that from happening. Because no nation truly owns its land. God moves governments, God moves nations, God does as God pleases, so that, as we would read in chapter 9 about Jacob and Esau, so that his purposes will be met. And it doesn't take a whole lot of looking in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation and other places, to see that God, and the Old Testament in a big way, God planned on bringing his people back, meaning the Israelites, gathering them from the four corners of the earth and concentrating them back into that land of Israel. And viewing it in the same manner as he viewed the original promised land for them. I think they would do well. You know, Israel's not a very religious nation. It's one of the most liberal nations on the planet. Now, I'm not saying it's the most liberal or the worst or the least moral, but, and yes, there are very religious Jewish people in Israel. I'm not saying none. But it isn't the Bible and the, or even the Torah and God and their inheritance and Moses that drives them. For the most part, they're very worldly people. But God has pulled them together, and the day will come when they will look on him whom they pierced with anguish and regret and belief that their Messiah is the Christ. But enough for that for us for today for now. There are other things in this passage that I think are good to remind ourselves of. One is they couldn't charge interest to fellow Israelites on loans. That an Israelite could not become a slave permanently of another Israelite. They could sell themselves into slavery, but in the year of Jubilee, they went just like everybody else did, back to their home place, back to the land, back to the inheritance that will come as a result of the year of Jubilee and the apportioning of it, the land during the time of the conquest. They also, as slaves, were to be treated as a hired hand, as a fellow brother, not as a slave that could be abused and misused. All right, let's go back to Numbers 36. Questions, comments? Okay. So we can see what would happen in the year of Jubilee. If they, when they received this inheritance, And if at marriage they went with another tribesman, then they would have their inheritance come back to them, and the tribal boundaries would become confusing at the time of Jubilee. And as multiple Jubilees would add up, it would just get more and more so. So Moses communicates the solution. Yahweh's solution is marry who they want, but out of their own tribe. And in verse 8, this is going to be applied to similar situations. If you remember, when the issue initially came up, God didn't just fix it for this one set of daughters. He said, if you don't have a son to pass the inheritance to, then he started going out through the various kinship relationships and finally ended up with, if none of these things fit, then whatever's the nearest kin, they get it. And so as we continue to have those kinds of issues, if women are the inheritors, then they have to marry within their own tribe. And the only way a woman could be an inheritor is if she wasn't already married. So you know that you're dealing with men, women who are not married at that point in time. Okay. And verse 10, the daughters of Zelophehad, I keep trying to say it the other way, followed their instructions. They married their uncle's sons. And so the inheritance remained within the tribe. And then the last verse of the book, and this concludes the commandments of Moses given on the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho. So that brings us to the end of the book of Numbers. And I've got this page out of place. But Numbers goes on to give us a lot of information. We saw the transfer of the leadership to Joshua at Moses' request here in these last few chapters. In these last few chapters, the other things we saw were laws about offerings, laws about vows. We saw God direct Moses to have them lead a revenge raid on Midian and all of the spoils that were taken. We see Reuben and Gad and eventually half of the tribe of Manasseh say, we want to settle on the east. And so that is arranged. We see the plans for apportioning Canaan as well as the Levitical cities of refuge. And today we got to see how some fine-tuning was done on the whole concept of daughters inheriting from their father these lands that were to be kept perpetually within their family and so on, and some of the issues that might come up. But there's one thing we don't actually see. And what is that? Death of Moses. Moses is still alive at the end of Numbers, but he's not at the beginning of Joshua. So as a part of our introduction to Joshua, we're going to spend some time elsewhere. Now, God did tell Moses in chapter 27, go up to the mountain. When you go up to the mountain, then you'll see the land, and it is there that you will die in the same manner that Aaron did. You'll be gathered to your fathers, to your people. So let's begin Deuteronomy a bit. And I initially had read the last chapter of Deuteronomy and said, this is going to work great. Well, then when I get down to actually preparing to teach the last chapter of Deuteronomy, I said, No, this is like watching a movie that has a prolonged death scene by an actor at the end and telling the actor all he can say is the last line. It just doesn't work. So we're going to go back to Deuteronomy chapter 27 to start this discussion. We need to talk about Deuteronomy a little bit. Deuteronomy is a book that focuses on the events and the teaching and the interactions between God and Moses and Moses and the people in this time that they spent there on the plains of Moab across from Jericho. And there's a lot of rich stuff here. And what I'm going to do is focus on the last round of Moses' teaching and preaching to the people leading up to his death and then his death. And so in the whole book, you're looking at instructions about the promised land as well as warnings and those kinds of things from Moses. And right before chapter 27, there were some laws and instructions given from God through Moses. But this is really the beginning of his departure from his role as God's appointed leader of the Israelites. And there's some very directive words here that are intended to galvanize Israel. It's not just platitudes, remember. This is a time to stir them up and to stir them up toward obedience, to stir them up toward listening to God, to following Joshua, but doing the things that God has told them by this time over and over and over again. And so let's just read that. We're going to start with the first 10 verses. We'll see how far we get today. Then Moses and the elders of Israel charged the people, saying, "Keep all the commandments which I command to you today. So it shall be on the day when you cross the Jordan to the land where the Lord your God gives you, that you shall set up for yourselves large stones and coat them with lime, and write on them all the words of this law when you cross over, so that you may enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised to you. So it shall be when you cross the Jordan, you shall set up on Mount Ebal these stones, as I am commanding you today, and you shall coat them with lime. Moreover, you shall build there an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not wield an iron tool on them. You shall build the altar of the Lord your God of uncut stones, and you shall offer on it burnt offerings to the Lord your God. And you shall sacrifice peace offerings and eat there, and rejoice before the Lord your God. You shall write on the stones all the words of this law very distinctly." Then Moses and the Levitical priests spoke to all Israel, saying, "Be silent and listen, O Israel. This day you have become a people for the Lord your God. You shall therefore obey the Lord your God and do his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today." And so this is a strong charge to get them in the right mindset, to help them buy into, become part of, become determined to do the very things of God that he's asked them to do. Moses gathers together with the elders. This isn't just Moses standing up. He's got the tribal leaders there with him as he gives him these words. And it starts with, "Keep all the commands I command you today." He focuses on that because that's the problem they have constantly, is keeping the commands. And we can see what Paul will say about all of the commands in general about keeping the law and how the law was a burden, but through Christ it's not a burden, but they've got this burden and it's theirs. And he says, so when you cross the Jordan into the land given to you by Yahweh, set up large stones and coat them with white lime. Well, it's lime and it is white. And when you do that, you're going to write on them all of the words of this law. This is no small task. What are the words of this law? That's a fair question. It's one that isn't given an explanation here in the book of Deuteronomy. Most would say we're talking about the entire set of commands. If you were to sort through the book of Deuteronomy, write everything from the book of Deuteronomy that's a command on this stone or set of stones. And you're to write them all down, the words of this law, no small task. It will take some time. It's also going to take some skill. But Moses tells them why they need to do it. Why do they need to do it? It's there in verse 3, I believe. Yeah, verse 3.
So you can enter the land.
so you can enter the land. If you don't follow this commandment, your entry into this land may be a failure. You need these laws. It isn't just that they are there or that there's a monument built toward them, but that you need them and you need to know them. You need to write them down so that you can go back and review and look and see. This is a testimony to what you are going to agree to do to follow God when you go into this land. Get them down. Use them. You need them. They're not a burden to you. They are your pathway. Now, it may be burdensome to keep them all, but they are more so what enables you to enter this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. You want this great land? God says that he's going to drive out the inhabitants. He's going to give them to you. It's going to be yours, but do this on the way so that it will go as promised. And this is done as promised by, and he says, the Lord your God. What that starts with in the Hebrew is, you know, Yahweh and Jehovah are interchangeable. We really don't know which way it was said, but it's Yahweh followed by Elohim. As promised to you by Yahweh Elohim. Yahweh is the name of God. Elohim, it's the great I am, so that's descriptive in that way. The great existing God. Elohim is typically the God Almighty, the one of strength and power and in charge of everything. And he's not just by name Yahweh Elohim, but he's also the God of your fathers, as promised to you. It raises the importance of the law. It's a promised land by Yahweh, but it's also a law given by Yahweh. And obedience is expected. That's their path of worshiping God. That's how they worship him, as obedience. It's the path to this prosperous land, and it's in direct connection with their success. In verse 4, it says, when you cross on Mount Ebal, set up the stones coated with lime. So where are they going to build this? And Ebal is pretty much in the center of the promised land, just north of Shechem. You remember Shechem? Shechem is where Yahweh first appeared to Abraham in the land. It's the site of Abraham's first altar. Very symbolic, going back to the place that God came to Abraham and met with him, and the place where Abraham built an altar to worship Yahweh in the promised land, the first place. Now, on your path there, on your trip through, you're going to build an altar just like Abraham did. It's not going to be cut stones. It's going to be uncut stones, probably just what, yes, sir?
How many years?
Well, so about 440 years since Jacob went, I'm doing this off the top of my head, since Jacob went to Egypt. And Jacob was not young when he went to Egypt, so that's the third generation. Maybe 150 to 200 years after Abraham. So I'm going to say in the range of 600 years, plus or minus a fair amount. Now, who would have a better thought could refine that a little bit? Anybody? So, that's very rough, okay? And so, here they are, and they're going to build this at Shechem. And they're going to do what on this offering? They are going to, first of all, offer what? A burnt offering. Some of you overestimate my hearing. I know you whispered it, but I still heard it, but I can't promise I'll do that every time. Okay. So they're going to do burnt offerings there to begin with. What is the purpose of the burnt offering? Atonements. There is an offering of atonement that's very much like this and is a burnt offering, but the general burnt offering is dedication, a commitment to service. It's worship. It's all of those things that says, Yahweh, you're a great God. I'm me, and I'm going to follow you, and I'm dedicating myself to you. I'll sacrifice anything to you. It's all yours. I'm yours. And that's what it's here for. There may have been atonement thoughts that went along with that, because certainly nobody can do those things without atonement. And so his title here is a little bit more generic than that. But then what are they supposed to do? A peace offering. What's the purpose of the peace offering? Well, the peace offering is saying, we're at peace, God, you and I, or you, God, you and this people. And so there are portions of that peace offering that are burnt, but then there are portions of it that are consumed by the people there. And the concept is, we're eating a meal with God. We're at peace with each other. We're on the same page, and you are God, and we are your people, and we're at peace, and we're ready to follow you. And so this is really a time of absolute worship, of recognition of God and his mercies toward them, recognition that God is accepting them and moving forward. And so they're going to eat this peace offering there, and they're going to rejoice before Yahweh, your God. And I don't think we ought to minimize that statement at the end, your God. He's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He's the God of your fathers. But here, Moses in front of the elders is saying, he's your God. This relationship has got to be founded on, we follow God. He's our God. When he commands, we obey. That's the relationship that needs to be here. Question, comment so far? Well, we've gone down through verse 7. Moses goes back to in verse 8. So write on the stones all the words of the law. Probably the whole book of Deuteronomy. And he gives a description of the nature of how they're to do this. How are they to do it? Very plainly. When you're done, it should be legible. It should be readable by anybody that can read what you wrote. And it's there to be an in-our-face reminder of what God has told us to do. And that's why the stones need to be white. That would be a good background to put very legible writing. They really need to be white because God said so. But there's a practical advantage of doing what God said. I'll put it that way. And then in verse 9, Moses says, be silent and listen. If there was murmuring going on at that moment, it should have stopped. Be silent and listen, O Israel. He's drawing attention to, you need to get this. This day, you have become a people, a nation. Not a nation for your own strength and might and power, but a nation that is for Yahweh, your God. Moses, in these final chapters of the book of Deuteronomy, is bringing them together as a people, giving them their identity as a nation and as followers of God, as children of Abraham, and in every other way that they might be joined together. You are united, and you're united under Yahweh. And in verse 10, therefore, obey Yahweh your God. Do all his commandments and his statutes, which I give you today. And so Moses is making a very strong plea, and what should be a very galvanizing speech to the people of Israel, to unite them to get ready to go into the promised land. Questions, comments, thoughts? Well, we're going to get a lot of warnings. And declarations, as we go through the rest of these ending chapters of Deuteronomy, that are going to say that Moses didn't say these things without knowing the people he was talking to through God himself. And so we'll be looking at how these words are further reinforced and the potential for failings are brought forward as we look at the chapters ahead. So I'll be seeing you next time. Thank you.